Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Forget about getting enlightened or knowing God. Just try and be, you know, kind to people. Compassionate, loving, you know. So from that point of view, I totally understand. How about just getting to know yourself through this incredible process that psychedelics provide? Hey everyone, it's Raghu back with Mind Rolling, and I have a wonderful guest today, Sean Lawler. Sean, welcome to the show, to the podcast.
Thank you, Raghu.
And Sean has an incredible book called Psychedelic Revival Towards a New Paradigm of Healing. And
thank you.
How long did this take to write this book, Sean? I mean, everybody out there, this is close to 500 pages. No, well, 400 pages.
Yeah, what did it clock in at? Like four?
Four something, yeah.
Yeah, 420, 430. Yeah, I tend to write a lot. We had to cut quite a bit. but it took about somewhere in the three to four year range, kind of depending on exactly when you put the starting point.
Yeah. I know what that's like. I just went through it myself for an audiobook that I did with my friend Duncan Trussell. You should. You know Duncan, who Duncan is?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, we
should. He's hilarious.
Yeah, but he'd be interested in all of this. So awesome. Everything that you're expressing in this book, which is, by the way, everybody, is really quite complete. I mean, you've done some excellent research. I mean, there's stuff. I thought I knew a bunch of stuff, but I didn't know nothing compared to what you've done. But before we even go there, can you tell us how you got to the point where you realized, gee, there might be something that could help me transform out of what society wants me to be like into a lot of a freer, more spacious, a more integrated life. How did that coalesce for you?
Well, first of all, I thank you so much for your words about the book. I really, really appreciate it, especially coming from you. But what came up for me in hearing that question was when I was 19 or 20 and smoked cannabis for the first time. And I come from St. Louis, Missouri, and was raised in a pretty conservative kind of environment. And I don't think I really had a original thought. I still question sometimes if I have had any original thoughts or even if that exists. But at that time, I mean, I was just going through the motions, and it kind of freaked me out. It wasn't like the first time I'd smoked, but I got to a point where I felt like I had a, I don't know, maybe some form of an existential crisis, and I didn't even know what that was. And it was just like all of a sudden, the universe was so much vaster than I had ever even considered, and more terrifying as well. And it reflected back on me that the way I was living was just kind of a lie, and just kind of going through these patterns that had been handed down to me through family, through society, all kinds of different things. And that if I didn't start like changing things, I was going to for sure be really miserable, like probably not that far down the road, and just not feel like my life was meaningful. And so I started to study philosophy in college, and that led me to writing and all kinds of different stuff, and psychedelics as well. Wasn't that much longer after that I took mushrooms. And
oh, so it was mushrooms, huh, for you?
That was my first psychedelic, unless you consider cannabis a psychedelic.
Yeah, especially ingesting it. It certainly can do that.
Yes.
As I said that, I just remembered ingesting cannabis at a Bob Marley concert way back when, and just joining in with the shamanistic thing that he represented, that he was, you know. And I never was so tuned in on that particular substance as I was that night with Bob.
Wow. That just gave me full body chills.
Yeah, really. It was. So, okay, first journey on psilocybin, what came up for you? Well, obviously, this directly initiated you into what much of your life's work is really. And Sean does ketamine-assisted therapy amongst his writing and so on and so forth. Yeah, so what was that that moment like?
First of all, I want to say it's tough being the recipient of questions with you, because I feel like you have, just from that story alone, you have such an objectively more interesting life than me.
But, no.
maybe one of these days I'll get to interview you.
Okay.
But yeah, that's, I was fortunate enough to do a semester abroad while I was an undergraduate. And so it was a semester in Australia, outside of Sydney. And that was where I endeavored to take mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, for the first time. And I mean, it goes down in history as one of the greatest days of my life. It's, I think, in the intro for the book. I get to it pretty early in the book. Just walking outside on a beautiful day with friends to this park where I'd spent so much time just staring at the trees and meditating and watching the ducks on this pond. And there were just beautiful sculptures all around, and it was a deep kind of connection, and it felt nourishing and familiar in a way that, like a lost sense of something really deep, like something that I knew a lot more, I guess, when I was more innocent back in my earlier days. I don't think in my adult life or young adult life I had ever felt so at ease and just so kind of interconnected with just this ongoing dynamic flow of life inside me and outside me. And I really don't think I took that much. Didn't quite measure it. We had a bag and just kind of eyeballed it and split it evenly among friends, which wouldn't necessarily recommend. But it was maybe 2 grams or less, but it was just wonderful. And then there was more of that bag left, and I took some again a month later at a Simon and Garfunkel concert, which was one of the last times they'd performed together. And they'd been kind of my music spirit guides for that whole trip. It was just so many amazing synchronicities that came together. And that was a profound cathartic release. I mean, I was just weeping and so connected to the music and filled with joy and feeling love for my family and just amazed, absolutely amazed.
You did say one thing, that you wouldn't recommend, just everybody popping in that bag and, you know, just sharing the glory. But I guess I do want to say, you know, in terms of that, I mean, what you're speaking to, which is the result of this extraordinary medicine, the interconnectivity of all things, you know, just that basic premise, which there isn't anybody who has experimented with psychedelics that wouldn't say, yep, absolutely, interconnectivity. I felt at one with everything. And I just also would say, in the same vein as you wouldn't recommend people to just start grabbing it and throwing it down out of a baggie, this is not something, psychedelics, I mean, is not necessary for everyone. You have to take psychedelics if you really are going to experience true nature. Just not true. Look at the Tibetans, for instance.
Yeah.
I think that's important because it's important because of the way it connects with the reality of the experience, with the reality of the experience through non-psychedelic means, and the way that, you know, the mystical, you speak to it in the book, right? The mystical and the psychedelic, the spiritual and the psychedelic. And interestingly enough, and I'm sure we're going to call on you here when we actually get this together, but Ram Dass wanted us to do something around science, spirituality, and psychedelic. And we're calling it science, spirituality, and psychedelic insight. And nothing whatsoever to do with therapy, because MAPS, and, you know, which you're associated with as well, has covered that, you know, pretty well. Mm-hmm. But to speak to the inner investigation into our true nature, and the integration of the ineffable experience. So we're putting a summit together, and we were going to try and get it in before the end of the year, but it looks like it'll be next spring. And, you know, get some of the people that each one of them, like, if I know a couple of people, scientists, right, that have that heartful perspective, which is unusual for someone engaged in material, a bit of materialism, and kind of a dig, but not really. Rational mind dependency, shall we say. So, yeah, so people are going to be bringing that to it. And everybody out there, if you're listening, just get on ramdass.org mailing list so you get informed when we're going to put this thing together, which it'll be in the spring of 25. Anyhow, I just wanted to suggest to everybody that there are so many experiences that people have that do not include the ingestion of psychedelic substances to arrive at the same place. And I don't know how much, Sean, you know about Ram Dass and his journey, But
pretty good amount.
Yeah. So you know, you remember, of course, he gave our guru Neem Karoli Baba, you know, hefty doses, which I found out at MAPS convention last summer.
Oh, nice.
From someone that it was, yeah, that white lightning was like 600 mics of pure LSD. So he had a few of those. He'd toss them in his mouth, right? And nothing happened, except that he did say, this is good for beginners what he said, and the analogy was to have you experience the totality of interconnectivity, love, compassion, and so on. He said, you get to be in the room with Christ for a couple of hours, but then you got to leave. Ultimately, best to love everyone and tell the truth and feed people, is what he said. So that is something that I like to emphasize whenever I speak with people who have great experience in the psychedelic world. You know, we want to make sure we're not, you know, proselytizing basically for psychedelics, because it is not the only way.
Yeah,
that was in the legal agreement, I guess.
Yeah, there are people who reach out either to talk or to pursue psychedelic therapy, and I get a question fairly often, which is like, should I take psychedelics? Like, people will ask that, and I just think your point is so important that, like, I can't tell someone that. That's a really personal decision. We could point to the science and share our own experiences and give information about things. But yeah, there's no should around it coming from anywhere, but I guess inside themselves and can help them come to a decision.
I mean, the reality for everybody, regardless of psychedelics, just the path, which psychedelics are part of a potential use in the path. And of course, those of us from back in the 70s and all that, you know, we definitely took that path. And now this revival, which it's 400 pages of like incredible material from all walks of the psychedelic world. And we still get, Sean, oh God, took some psilocybin the other day and listened to a Ram Dass talk and my whole world opened up, you know, same thing that was in 1960 when he came back from India in 1967, 1968, same thing. It's all, you know, that time span hasn't changed anything. So yeah, it is there, but it's part of the path. It is not the path, which I think is also problematic because of the way people can engage with ayahuasca in particular, I think. Well, not just ayahuasca, but just the, we've got to go back to that experience. There is a bit of a entrapment there.
Yeah, absolutely. That really surprised me about ayahuasca and some of the other plant medicines. I had my first one. I've only taken it a few times. The first time was, I think, probably objectively the most like overwhelming and terrifying experience of my life, which resolved nicely. But like, I was like, I'm never doing that again. Yeah. And people, you know, were planning to do it next weekend and the weekend after that. And I experienced such healing, and then kind of right back and into it. And yeah, something like didn't digest well in me. Like, I don't want to judge other people's past, but I did observe, you know, people who didn't seem to kind of be maintaining a kind of footing or groundedness or integrating things, kind of chasing the peak experience.
Yeah. Chasing the dragon is sort of another genre of drugs. But
kind of applied. Yeah.
Oh, boy. I love some of the quotes, Sean, in the book. You know, I love people's quotes. This one, I never heard this. Humphrey Osmond, who wrote a note to Aldous Huxley, who we love. To fathom hell or soar angelic, just take a pinch of psychedelic.
Yeah, apparently, at least the story I came across is that's kind of how he introduced the term when he created it.
Yeah. So we just talked about, you know, science and mysticism, and a little bit, at least we introduced it. And you introduced somebody, and I'd love for you to tell her story, because it sounds fascinating, tragic as well. And that's Maria Sabina. And of course, the story of the, I guess it was the Wassons who went seeking the magic mushroom. Can you tell that story? I actually, because, you know, it's funny, Ram Dass, as you know, went with Leary, and Leary had a place in Mexico, and he was where he discovered psilocybin, the mushrooms, and he invited Ram Dass, and that's where that whole deal kind of began. So I never heard of these people, you know, in what, in the mid-50s or something, you know, 10 years before or 8 years, something. Yeah, can you tell that story?
Yeah, sure. I'll tell it to the best of my ability to probably get some of the dates wrong. It's been a bit since I've been in the book, but that these amateur mycologists, the Wassons, husband and wife duo, R. Gordon was a banker, and it turned out, I can't remember if I got into this in the book, but they were funded through, at least in part, through Project MK Ultra, the kind of CIA covert psychedelic research project, and other things as well. So there's records of a particular project that funded these trips. But Wasson had kind of caught wind of the survival of these kind of magic mushroom rituals and ceremonies in a particular region in Mexico, among the Maztec people. And so he and Valentina, his wife, traveled and kind of explored. And I think the story is that they just kind of came upon Maria Sabina. I can't remember the specifics of their meeting. I'm kind of mixing them up in my head with Carlos Castaneda and Don Juan. essentially got to know Maria Sabina and found out she was a Maztec curandera who facilitated these ceremonies with the children. I think the translation of her word for the mushrooms that grew there. And Wassons participated, and along with a photographer friend, and wrote a R. Gordon wrote an article in Life magazine, which was, you know, it's before my time, but apparently the biggest magazine, like, in at least the U.S., not beyond that.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful pictorial magazine.
Yeah. And there's a cover story called Seeking the Magic Mushroom, where he gave Maria Sabina an alias and described the journey and described the visions and kind of opened the recognition of magic mushrooms. I think the article was published in 1957. Kind of exposed it to a wide audience, and apparently brought a lot of people in the ensuing decade and a half, probably beyond, who came seeking the magic mushroom as well. And a part of the story that I think is really important is kind of Maria Sabina's perspective and side of things. She wrote a memoir. She was a poet as well, so she wrote things, and there's interviews from her time, and she tells stories of kind of the place being overrun and the small town being overrun with Westerners, and that they were often seeking it for the wrong reasons. And curiously, one of the wrong reasons that she described was to find God, which I thought was interesting, because that's something we still hear all the time in like the psilocybin research. And
any idea what she's speaking to?
I can speculate. I mean, I think it was just such a broader thing of like healing, for her. She would describe like singing like healing songs and getting sick for people, and maybe just their concept of the transcendental God was.
I mean, I actually tell people this all the time in retreats or podcasts or something. Forget about getting enlightened or knowing God. Just try and be, you know, kind to people, compassionate, loving, you know. So from that point of view, I totally understand. How about just getting to know yourself through this incredible process that psychedelics provide? And, you know, but I also saw she would be shown through the mushroom spirits. She would be shown the cause of people's sicknesses, soul loss, malevolent spirits, or human sorcerers. You wrote this, and she explained, the sickness comes out of if the sick vomit. Yucky. They vomit the sickness. They vomit because the mushrooms want them to. If the sick don't vomit, I vomit. This is her speaking. I vomit for them, and in that way the malady is expelled. Then, and this is something to really speak to as well. This is the guy who wrote the book, Stephen Beyer, Singing to the Plants, it's called. That sounds like a fascinating book.
Yeah.
Is that still available? Do you know?
Yeah, you can find it online.
Beyer added that Sabina, quote unquote, would then be able to cure the patient through the power of her singing. And you do address this in the book, and to me, it's super important, the way in which music works with a psychedelic experience. Even in therapeutic ketamine clinics, you know, lie down, you got a couple of people that are helping guide you, and, you know, music is a part of it. Why? Mm-hmm. Because it truly integrates us in a way that I don't think any other art can. And of course, people who love paintings and sculptures and so on will disagree with that. But I've always been, you know, music has been so much for me in my life.
Me too.
But yeah, I love that. Cure the patient through the power of her singing. Is there anything? Is there any recordings of her singing, by the way?
That is a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but I would like to learn the answer to that.
But why don't you talk a little bit about it? Because you do in the book, Music and Psychedelic Therapy, Providing a Structure for the Experience.
Sure. It's such an important thing, like you said.
In your therapy, I'm sure you're using it, obviously.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's very rare when I haven't. There's been one or two clients who just requested silence, and that's
really
wonderful as well.
Zen people, probably.
Yeah, yeah, probably so. Everything I've learned about indigenous uses of plant medicines in different places around the world with different medicines and different spiritualities and worldviews and culture, music has been a centerpiece of all of them, of all of the rituals, including Maria Sabina. And, you know, there's that fine line of not wanting to, you know, take from traditions that are different than ours in an exploitative way, but there's also this space to learn from, because if you know, we in the West don't seem to have as much in the way of roots with these kinds of experiences, or if we do, we're disconnected from them. But music seems to have always been there, you know, with the, even at the 60s, you know, and psychedelics coming to the forefront, there's such a close connection between LSD and music. And today's world, I think everyone's still trying to figure out the best way to go about the music, the right kind of music. You know, there's studies that Johns Hopkins has done with like classical music playlists versus kind of new agey playlists and things like that. But it holds the experience. And it a term that I think Stan Grof used in LSD psychotherapy, and I've heard it otherwise than that, is music as a carrier wave, like it kind of carry the experience. And with ketamine, which is the therapeutic psychedelic work that I do, it's like maybe even more essential because people in their dissociative state, like they routinely come back and say there is no difference between the experience and the music. There's no separation. It's just the music is the experience. They're like in the music. So there's a lot of responsibility in just choosing what songs, because they influence things so heavily.
And that's back to set and setting from Alpert and Leary.
Indeed.
But I like what this neuroscientist, Frederick Streeter Barrett, said: combining music and psychedelics may lead to a change in neural circuitry that may be stuck in patterns of negative emotional bias. And that may be just enough to give someone access to new perspectives on themselves and their lives and begin on the road to healing. I think that is so right on, Sean.
Yeah, that's a great quote from him. I think that was from a TED Talk, if I'm not mistaken. There's so many quotes in the book. But yeah, that's... Is that something that resonates with your experience? That kind of way that music helps like shift stuck neural patterns, circuitry?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, this man is a neuroscientist, so you know, of course, all of the research that's going in there, finding that we can change, we absolutely can change our habitual patterns and neurotic tendencies, and of course, this is. I mean, it's what you do with ketamine. I hate to admit to some of this stuff because it's just a pretty loose approach and not the honoring that, you know, I feel is so paramount in terms of engaging. But just before I went to India, when Ram Dass went back the second time, a couple of years, we got a whole batch of PCP, which is basically ketamine.
Right.
And what did we used to do? We used to go to the local, I was in Berkeley, California, the local Berkeley silent movie theater. Okay.
Nice.
And just sit there and completely get engaged on God knows, you know, because what ketamine did cuts everything else out. Ram Dass himself, using that particular substance, had the furthest out trip. I mean, he had a lot of really pretty far out trips, but I was witness to this particular one, and it was in India in the Himalayas. And I never saw anyone out there like that. Like the Silver Surfer from Marvel Comics, surfing through the cosmos. That was Ram Dass.
You could kind of envision that?
No, I happened to. No, we were at. This is really telling tales out of school. We were doing a meditation retreat. Neem Karoli Baba said, yeah, go up there and do a retreat. He was just getting rid of us, you know, all these hippies. And go follow, be with Ram Dass. And anyhow, so there was about 20 of us took over an ashram right in front, smack in front of the 26, 7, 8,000 foot Himalaya peaks. I mean, extraordinary. I just went back there a year and a half ago. I just hadn't been there in so long. And I remembered, oh my God, the living vibration of this. Anyhow, so he did take some PCP and ketamine. And I was living, I was above him where he took it in the room below. And there was shitty Indian kind of, you know, construction, and the floor had a hole in it. So I started hearing this wild noise, and then I go and I look down, there's Ram Dass. I would never be able to either mimic or describe what was coming out of his body in terms of sound. Talk about sound healing. I mean, to this day, I would never be able to do that. But in the end, we all kind of gathered around him and just, you know, took a different part of the body. All these people, we were stoned, Sean, for 1 week, not touching any kind of chemical, just him.
Wow. Wow, talk about a contact high.
Yeah, that was the greatest contact high I ever had. Oh, boy. All right.
That's amazing.
I don't know
if
Ram Dass would be happy about me telling that story. But you can't tell me not to unless it's in a dream right now.
Ram Dass stories never cease to amaze me. There are so many of them, and that's amazing. You had so many experiences with them.
Yeah, no, very fortunate. I mean, he was a great teacher as well. I mean, I wouldn't have trusted, and this is really, since we're speaking to this, trust is such a huge thing, and you have to trust your own guts. And to get there means to open up in different ways. But it doesn't have to be psychedelics, but definitely openings need to take place. And once you have that trust, then you know, is it right for me to do a ketamine session with Sean or not? You know, is it right for me to even experiment a little bit, but with someone I really... that's close to me, that can be my ground, you'll know it. And so trust, it's what I got from Ram Dass when I first met him. It was, oh, wow. You know, I completely trusted that he wasn't there for himself or even for his personality, Richard Halpert. He was there for me and what I needed and the unconditionality of that presence. And that went a long way to launch me into, you know, life. Here I am, you know, very fortunate. And so trust is a big, big deal. And it Absolutely. Allows us to make the right calls in our lives.
Totally. Yeah. And you hit on like the trusting of ourselves to kind of follow our intuition or inner guide or kind of however you conceive of it. And the importance of trusting who you're with if you're going to take psychedelics in a therapeutic or recreational setting, to be able to trust that that person is there to take care of you and cares about you and that you're safe with that person. And yeah, that inner trust piece, I learned so much working with clients, and I'm new in that career, and it's really, really difficult. Like, probably it feels harder for me than writing a book to like sit with clients and just keep learning from them. But I've learned a lot of people have lost trust in themselves and maybe have never even known that, oftentimes due to trauma or childhood traumatic experiences, where their voice was silenced or their reality was kind of negated or, I guess, the gaslit would be the term. And it's very murky in there for some people. So to kind of focus on trying to get to that deeper level of trust is so important.
And it's so prominent in their lives. In one's life, everybody has trauma. There's not anyone who gets away with it. As soon as you get a name when you're a baby, and at 6 months you realize there's some identity here that is me, and my name is Raghu. Oh, of course, my name wasn't that then. I was re-identified much later, thanks to God. So trauma happens because separation happens, isolation happens, okay? Protection, defense mechanisms, and then God bless you if you're in a family that's open and knows how to connect with some part of themselves that isn't lost in the miasma of our traditional society, especially the way it's grown. So you've got a thing, it's called, in the book, called trusting the process. So we were talking, you speak to exactly what we were talking about. Trust the process.
That's another layer. That's a term that I just heard used so often in psychedelic therapy, with MAPS and Johns Hopkins and just kind of the general lexicon. And yeah, that gets at that layer of kind of trusting what comes up in the psychedelic experience. And even if it's, you know, you're not touching the hand of God, maybe, you know, if you're that Humphrey Osmond quote, you know, to fathom hell or soar angelic, you know, maybe you wanted to soar angelic and you're fathoming hell, and to trust in the process is to trust that that's what you need in that moment and to be with it and it's okay.
Yeah, there's a nice quote here too. What you're talking about, the process, the inner healer. Psychedelics do not create a guide. It lives within us, and psychedelics invite it to the forefront. That's good. I love that, Sean. I mean, and that just supports that trust is such an important thing. And that, hey, let's go all the way to, you know, Dzogchen in Buddhism, which is you are that. You are the truth. You are true nature. You are free. We don't realize it because we have so much stuff, you know, in between the clouds. Ram Dass's great thing is just picture that a painting, and it's all cloudy, but then there's a little corner where you see a speck of blue. With proper intention and work on oneself to realize that these obscurations are impermanent, and the wind will blow them away, you know, that blue sky.
Yeah. Realize that is so big. I feel like I have moments of realizing that, but then when I'm just back in the grip of the stuff, it's like, where's that bit of blue? Where did it go? And then the gripping makes it further away.
Yeah. Clinging is tough.
Clinging. Yeah.
Clinging is tough.
Yeah.
I think we should address one thing, you know, that you do in the book, which is around recreational use and therapeutic use. Now, I have a great friend who is a psychonaut warrior. I mean, Bufo, the whole nine yards, you know.
Oh, hardcore.
Hardcore, yeah. And his basic attitude, his perspective is on being open to whatever does come to him in that moment, in through that. He trusts the process. I'll say he's one guy that trusts the process.
He really does.
I admire him. Yeah. But to say that he's using the tenets of set and setting, and he's a big Ram Dass person too, is not true. He is not. And I'm always, I'm like, what? You did what? And you went out and you were dancing at a psychedelic club or whatever it was. Really? But on the other hand, I know that he is true to himself. And it's manifesting in this way. And it's ridiculous for me. It's ridiculous for me to judge anything or anyone. But in this particular case, so recreational versus therapeutic, to speak to it.
Yeah. Well, think with my initial psychedelic stories of taking them, you know, from that bag and not measuring them, and then a Garfunkel concert kind of gave me away there. It's not, you know, a dogmatic therapy kind of guy. I mean, I think set and setting are really absolutely important tenets, and that a therapy office is one of, and probably infinite amount of possible ones, and one with a lot of control. But I mean, some, I would say most of my most impactful and powerful psychedelic experiences have been like outside of a therapy office and outside of a even kind of group, community kind of setting. And I kind of picked up, through writing about this stuff, and I just got kind of, I went as deep as I could into the whole psychedelic culture for a few years there. And there just seemed to be a lot of judgment around recreational experiences. And I kind of, my interpretation of that, which I've probably heard elsewhere also, is that we kind of needed that to bring the cultural narrative in a new direction that can move forward. Like, you know, Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, was such a kind of paradigm shifter, honestly. Like, and it really focused on the science because he knew that that's what convinces people. And it did. It got so many more people interested. Oh,
amazing. That's totally amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. Jeez. And at the same time, I think there was just this playing out where it's kind of like, well, this way of using psychedelics is good, but all the other ways are still bad. And it's like, well, all the other ways are still probably 99.9999% of like human uses throughout history.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's that simple. So I wanted to just kind of explore that space a little more, and especially when it gets into issues of access. You know, the therapy at the moment is super expensive and not everyone can access it. So is that just,
it's a big really problem. Awful, actually.
Yeah, it is. Totally.
On the other hand, I have to say, I have friends who've worked with people like you using ketamine with deep anxiety and depression, and it has worked, everybody.
That's awesome.
Definitely consider it. It doesn't work for, but nothing works for everyone.
Right.
But his name is Mike Finoia. He does a podcast. If you guys look on, go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling look up Sean Finoia, Finoia, I believe, and listen to his story of where he was at, and that what he went through within a year or two, he definitely came out the other side of it. And this is not new, and Sean, you must have many stories, positive stories.
At like a personal level or with the clients?
With clients.
I would say an ever-growing body of them. I really am quite new to this. I got my master's from Naropa University.
Yeah, that's great. By the way, that summit I'm telling you that we want to, that we are going to be doing in a year, including Ram Dass's purview on psychedelics, is a partnership with Naropa.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Good, because Ram Dass was a huge figure there at their foundation.
Yeah, no, when it started, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Coming full circle.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. I graduated in 2022. I did a year-long internship at two places. One was a community mental health center, and the other was a ketamine clinic here in Fort Collins called the Wholeness Center, a MAPS-affiliated site, and got some wonderful experience there. And now I work at a place called Reflective Healing, run by a really, really wonderful and compassionate person named Dori Lewis, who's been doing this for a really long time. We have a great team, and I've been doing ketamine therapy, I think, for about 2.5 years, and various frequencies of hours per week. So, you know, I'm working with a lot of clients, but I don't want to come from a perspective like I'm, you know, as seasoned as everyone, but I am witnessing people going through entire series of, you know, six ketamine sessions over the course of a few months and feeling dramatically different afterwards.
Yeah. And it's quite amazing. Yeah. This is in, are you in Colorado?
Yep. I'm in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Uh-huh. Right, right. Yeah. I didn't know that. God, there's so much here, Sean. I mean, there's stuff you write about nature and spaciousness, and that's also, aside from music, that's a big deal for me. Big methodology.
Another thing that's missing from the therapy office a lot of the time.
Yeah, right.
All the time.
yeah, right. And in this book, recognizing the revival's indigenous roots, we talked about it a little, bringing Maria into the conversation, but this is so hugely important. And further into the book, you talk about some of the unfortunate stuff that's happened in South America with shamans who were not appropriate. I don't know what other way to put it, but abusing power and all of that kind of stuff and violence happening. And listen, there are people who, you've got to be a somebody, as Ram Dass used to say, before you become nobody. And there are people that are doing this that aren't so much a somebody, they're dissembled personality-wise. And when they enter into these substances, it causes extreme problems for them. And then, of course, the repercussions of that have, you've pointed to it in the book. But the reality of how we need to bring, just speak to it, the indigenous truth around these substances and into our orbit.
Sure. Yeah, geez, this is, I mean, could write a lifetime of books exploring the different ways that indigenous cultures across the world have used different psychoactive plant medicines for, I mean, usually we don't know exactly how long, kind of speculate, usually a lot of centuries, if not millennia. And there's so many unfortunate histories of these uses, which pretty much across the board, as far as I've learned, which, you know, the quote at the beginning of my book is like, the farther one goes, the less one knows, or the farther one travels, the less one knows, that from the Tao Te Ching. And so that's the case with what I'm talking about now. I feel like I know less in a lot of ways after learning what I wrote. But in the United States, you know, there's a story I get into in the book of just the way that peyote use amongst Southwestern, usually, at least in the earlier days, Native American groups got persecuted, seen as like the devil worship, pagan, and you know, there was a systematic attempt to eradicate it, to destroy that, like, really, really old practice. And yeah, I get teared up talking about it, which is really interesting because I don't have any Native American connection, but it's just in my blood, that is, but
human,
yeah, it's
connection,
just really sad.
That's all you need.
Yeah. And talking to some folks who, I mean, they still carry trauma of all this. Yeah. And like, now I just think it's really important when we're all of a sudden psychedelic positive in this same culture that 100 years ago was doing this and putting them into boarding schools to try and, like, you know, get rid of that mentality. I mean, first of all, it's just amazing how the interconnectedness of different Native American cultures that came about in order to preserve and protect these ancient, meaningful customs, because they just knew how, like, without them, they lose themselves and, like, their identity and their roots. But yeah, now we're, you know, bringing all this stuff into the forefront, and everyone's like, yeah, psychedelics are actually great, and you know, we can talk about it, and it's wonderful, and, you know, so many wonderful things like we've been talking about. And yeah, there can still be this extractive mentality that's going on, where people just kind of go and seek, like, how can I get some peyote and, you know, feel that kind of meaning, which still kind of falls into this, like, capitalistic kind of, like, grasping for the big experience kind of thing. Yeah. And
yeah,
so yeah, there's this way of, like, wanting to get around that extractive mentality, but at the same time, like, honor these traditions, and by, like, listening and from what they're willing to share, ask questions, and getting to know about how, like, in different indigenous cultures, from the extent I've learned, which once again is really limited, it's like there's not a separation between rituals and culture and worldview and way of life. Like, there's so interwoven and braided together, like this web, whereas we still have these, you know, strict separations. This is that, this is that. Yeah. And
we are, you know, so polarized in every way. I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, you just speak to it, you see the way these people interact with us, with themselves, with each other. It's just, and we try to eliminate that,
right?
You know, as a threat. White culture. My God,
yeah,
karma is extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, those of us that have any way of, you know, with what you're doing, with what we are doing, at the top of the, actually, you know, who I talked to. So Joe Harrison from Naropa, I think you know who Joe is.
I know his name.
He runs the program. He's the head of the psychedelic curriculum there.
Oh, okay, yeah. Interesting. That started, like, right when I finished there.
Oh, he did? Oh, okay, yeah. Cool. Anyhow, when I started explaining what we wanted to do to represent Ram Dass's purview on psychedelics, as a way to discover who we truly are. And one of the very first sessions was our indigenous roots, bringing people in who can speak to the power of the wisdom that they bring to the table here. And he was so pleased. He said, "I'm so pleased that you went in that direction, because I am just completely in alignment that we need to honor." And we need to bring that wisdom in as much as possible. And MAPS has done some of that, by the way. MAPS has truly encouraged that. And, as you know, as part, they had people. I met them in Denver last summer. So, yeah. Anyway, yeah. I just had to bring that up, because I feel it's just absolutely so important, the honoring and the integration of that wisdom.
I agree, and those are perfect words, honoring and learning from integrating wisdom without like stealing or exploiting. And I agree that MAPS has been, like, really responding to feedback through the years, and they're really wonderful at just growing and kind of embodying that principle that we can continue to change and grow and become better over time. And they've done that with this particular subject, for sure.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of at the end of our podcast here. I do want to quote a quote that you use in the book when we talked about feeling the spaciousness of the universe. You quote, "Can we feel the spaciousness of the universe in the comfort of our favorite armchair?" If the city imprisons us, can we create spaciousness within ourselves without having to escape into nature? Well, I don't know if I call it escape, without having nature accessible in the moment, I think would be good. But you quote William Blake from The Auguries of Innocence. And this is, oh, it's William Blake, okay? So got to be good.
Yeah.
"To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." That is so beautiful and holds everything. Psychedelic, non-psychedelic, you know, just holds everything in terms of who we truly are.
And yeah, you just really read it so beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
I really felt that as you were reading it. Appreciate that.
Yeah, no, it's really great. So everybody, we'll in the show notes, Psychedelic Revival, when is it coming out, actually?
June 4th.
June 4th. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wait a minute now. They must be, who's doing this? Sounds True, who I'm quite friendly with. They are doing pre-orders. They've got to be, right?
Yes. Yeah. Pre-orders are available.
Are happening. Okay. Yeah, well, can you send me, so I can send it to the producers and all that, a link to pre-order it. So everybody, you can pre-order this book, which again, I say is very complete and has things in it that, I mean, doesn't mean anything that I didn't know before, but there's a chock full of just that little thing from William Blake is enough. It's worth the price of admission as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you're a very, very generous reader, Raghu. I really, really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Looking at my book and having me on the show, talking. Yeah. It was really great.
Yeah, we'll do some other stuff, I'm sure.
We
have a psychedelic, Ram Dass Psychedelic Fellowship, where people gather together on Zoom and so on. And we have speakers. We'll have to get you, I'll get you hooked up with that, because I think that would be nice for you to share with the Ram Dass Fellowship.
Thank you so much.
It's called
the
Explorers Club.
Awesome.
Isn't that great? All right. So again, everybody, this is Mind Rolling. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling, and you can see, get all of the links, the link to pre-order Sean's book, and be able to get in touch with him, especially if you're in his area and you want to work with him. So we'll give you his website, and then go take advantage on BeHereNowNetwork.com of all of the great teachers that we have there, from Jack Kornfield to Sharon Salzberg to Robert Svoboda. Do you know who Robert Svoboda is?
I don't know.
Oh, you should check him out. He lived amongst the, he lived with an Aghori in India around a little after the time we were early 70s. He was more mid, late 70s. Who Aghori is the left hand path of God. They do shit like meditate on corpses in cemeteries, right? Really heavy stuff.
The left-hand path.
Yeah. But most of it is, unfortunately, and I've met them, shall we say, substantially genuine might not be the case in some of this, you know, because they get into really occultism rather than spirituality. This guy was the real thing. And Robert wrote 3 books, the Agora Trilogy, that are fantastic. Yeah, look, Svoboda, Svoboda, and he's one of the podcasters on the Be Here Now Network.
Okay, I'm going to check him out.
Please do. All right, everybody, we'll see you next week.
Thanks again.
Ram Ram.